Okay. Hello, everyone. Very good evening to you. Welcome to this panel discussion on the European Parliament elections 2019, a watershed election, if ever there were one, what with Brexit, the seemingly unstoppable rise of populism, the Spitzenkandidaten experiment, and others. Very pleased to welcome you all here to this event, which is organised as a spin-off from the 2019 Diplomacy Ball, financed by LSE Ideas. This event is also run in coordination with three student societies, the UN Society, Amnesty International Society, and the Grimshaw Club, which I believe is the oldest student society at LSE. Well done. My name's Ben Martill. I'm a research fellow at the Dahrendorf Forum here at LSE Ideas, and I'll be chairing this event. Just introduce our speakers before the talks. To my left is Dr. Nicola Colotti. Is senior lecturer in diplomacy and international governance at Loughborough University, London, and his research concerns EU negotiations and the politics of the Council. To Nicola's left is Mary Honeyball, MEP, who entered the European Parliament in 2000, is a member of S&D, and has been involved in Labour politics all her political career, and Ms. Honeyball is Labour's spokesperson on the Legal Affairs Committee and a member of the Culture and Education Committee. And on her left is Georgina Wright, who is a senior researcher on the Brexit team at the Institute for Government just down the road, and her interests are in negotiations and the views of the EU27. So, what we're going to do, we'll ask our speakers to talk for about 12 to 15 minutes on elements of the elections. Then we'll turn over to you, the audience, we'll take a few questions, and we'll get the discussion going. Okay? So we'll go through in alphabetical order, beginning with Dr. Colotti.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Ben, for the presentation and for inviting me here. So, we are here to talk about the European Parliament and the upcoming European elections. But, of course, we are also in the middle of another Brexit week. So I will try to merge a little bit the two topics, talking about the European Parliament and Brexit, very briefly, because I want to introduce, I think, what is an important concept. But so the European Parliament and Brexit, I mean, I'm bored, I think, like anyone else about Brexit. It's very boring. But I think there are a couple of things about the European Parliament and Brexit which are quite interesting. Because if we go back probably 2 years ago when the whole process started, you probably were reading the news back then. People were discovering the Article 50, the famous or infamous Article 50, and then people were saying, well, actually, the European Parliament has a role here. And people were saying, well, maybe the European Parliament will be, these MEPs are very disruptive. They might be like a wrecking ball. They might disrupt the whole process. I remember reading even seasoned commentator saying, well, we have to take into account the European Parliament. The European Parliament might veto the deal because the European Parliament can veto the deal. And now we are here 2 years later and nobody is speaking anymore about the European Parliament and Brexit. Instead, everybody is looking at the UK Parliament and Brexit. So now what does this tell us? I mean, also then Verhofstadt was nominated like at the beginning, the real Brexit coordinator and everybody, this Belgium federalist is a bit crazy, he will disrupt, he will want to have anything. Nothing of that happened. So why is it coming? The parliament has been very, very quiet and responsible. Responsible is the word that I would like to emphasize. So why is it the case? Well, I mean, there are, of course, several reasons. One reason is that because the preferences of the European Parliament are very much aligned with the preferences of the member states and the Commission task force. So the job is quite easy compared to the UK Parliament. But there's also another maybe procedural reason, because Barnier did what Theresa May didn't do, which was to involve the Parliament into the Brexit negotiations since the very, 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 very beginning. I mean, Barnier did it for a number of reasons, also maybe for personal reasons, but also because he knew that the Parliament has a veto at the end of the process, so we need to get the Parliament on board. So actually, the Parliament, if you read the Article 50, the Parliament only has the power at the end of the process, which is whether to ratify or to veto it. But the parliament managed to be informed at each and every stage of the negotiation process. I mean, there were sometimes even before the member states. I interviewed people in Brussels in the permanent representation saying, well, actually, the parliament was receiving information before us, which is what's going on here. So the parliament was involved, informed pretty much throughout the process very much. And it was also involved in the negotiations to a good extent, especially on citizens' rights. On the other two issues, the Northern Irish border and the money, and the Parliament was less interested. But on the citizens' rights, was also able to change the part of the withdrawal agreement on citizens' rights in some meaningful way. So the Parliament was an active participant involved by Barnier since the very beginning. So what I want to say here, is that the Parliament behaved really responsibly. So responsibly internally and externally. So I don't know how much you know about how the Parliament organizes itself internally to deal with Brexit. So basically, it set up like 5 political groups out of 8, basically joined what they call the Brexit Steering Group. And these 5 political groups are the far left, GUE, you have the Greens, you have SND, you have ALDE, and you have the EPP, the Conservatives. So these 5 groups have managed to find consensus throughout the entire process, which is quite striking because you can imagine that the far left and the EPP, even on Brexit, they don't really have the same idea positions. But they basically said, I mean, Brexit is such an important process, so we basically give up our internal fights. We have divisions, but we suspend our fights in terms of these negotiations, and we try to be all together and responsible. So responsible internally, but also responsible externally, in a sense, as I was saying, very cooperative with the other institutions, with Barnier, with the task force, and with the member states. Now, why am I talking about responsibility? Because I don't know how much you know about the European Parliament, but the European Parliament at the beginning of the European integration process was not really an important actor. Didn't really have much power. But over the decades, it acquired many, many powers, and now in many issues, it's an equal co-legislator together with the member states. Not in all of them, but in many of them. But every time, the parliament at the beginning, when the parliament didn't have so much power, if you look at also at the positions of the parliament or what the MEPs were saying back then, they were very, I would say, so for instance, let's take immigration. So in the 90s, even in 2000, when the parliament didn't really have so much power in terms of immigration policies in the EU, MEPs were very liberal, saying, no, we should always protect all rights of all immigrants. Then when the parliament got co-decision powers and sense that their vote really mattered, you can see how the parliament changed. It became much more responsible, less liberal, much more responsible. And the same thing with economic governance. The parliament also managed to reform the European economic governance in 2011, 2013. And if you've seen the behavior of the parliament, was very much responsible. Again, what do I want to say here? It's something that maybe the other two panelists would not agree necessarily with me on this point, but so why is the parliament behaving always so responsible? I mean, actually, the parliament is, in my view, behaving quite responsibly, especially in what we can call core state powers. So, though not in the single market when you have to negotiate, like the standards of toy safety or whatever, but when it comes to immigration, or which is very close to the heart of the member states, or when it comes to fiscal rules. And then in these policy areas, you see that the parliament behaves differently. No, the European Parliament knows, well, actually, here, the big boys here are still the member states. I'm using the gender on purpose. So in these areas, the European Parliament knew that the member states were in charge, and they were not really picking up many fights. Why was it the case? My view is that because MEPs, yeah, probably you have a different view on this, but it felt that, yes, MEPs are the only, the European Parliament is the only directly elected chamber in the EU. But my view is that they know that at the end of the day, the member states, and especially the heads of state and government, are more legitimate than them. So they were happy to take a sort of a side when the big important issues really met. So where this long introduction is to go to the point is, what's happening now with the new elections? On the one hand, is will the parliament still behave that responsibly? You know, because there's a narrative that these populist parties are saying, well, actually, I mean, the European Parliament elections were known to be so-called second-order elections, in a sense. For the first order national elections for the states are the elections that basically elect the national parliaments. And then you have midterm elections. Sometimes it's the European Parliament elections. Sometimes it's the local elections, etc. But basically, in these second order elections, you were voting not for the European Parliament or for the regional parliament, but you were voting for or against, especially against the government. So basically, even European Parliament elections were fought on national issues, etc. But now things maybe are changing, because now the European Union is much more politicized in the member states. So what will happen now? Because if you see, at the domestic politics of the member states, you see how European issues are much more present. Now people are contesting, especially fiscal rules. If you look at Southern Europe, they really contest fiscal rules. So probably European elections would be fought more on European issues than before. What will that mean for the European Parliament? So it might be that a European Parliament coming a more nationalistic European Parliament will also behave differently in the legislation. The point is, it depends on the numbers. I think that in the 2019 elections, we will not see much of a big difference. I think that you will cover that much more. But if in 2024, 2029 elections, if you see the rise of nationalist parties even more, you might see really the European Parliament behaving differently in legislation as we have seen in the last three decades. How much time do I have?
5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I'll mention another thing then. So I'll talk about the rise of populism then in this possibly new European Parliament. I'm not trying to predict what will happen. I think maybe Georgina will also talk a little bit more about the composition, the possible composition of the future European Parliament. But one thing that I want to stress is clearly, if you look at the populist parties all over Europe, they will group in two possibly political groups in the European Parliament. The point is that, as Ben actually also pointed out in a number of his pieces, clearly, if you look at the policy positions of these populist parties, are quite different from one another. One example is, again, fiscal rules, economic policies. If you look at my country, which is Italy, and a neighboring country, which is Austria, and if you look at two populist parties there, or three populist parties in some ways, you see that the Austrian populist party and its leader Kurz, who is now in the government, basically saying, well, actually, you know, when it comes to economic policies, states have to be fiscally responsible. Whereas the rhetoric in Italy is completely different. Say, well, now things will change. Populist parties will come to Brussels. We'll go to Brussels. We'll take over the EU institutions. And now we nationalist parties or populist parties will be able to change these fiscal rules that we never liked. Because one of the rhetoric in Southern Europe and especially in Italy is that one of the problems of the country is that Italy was forced to go through austerity in the 2000s. And the reason was these fiscal rules which were adopted in the Stability and Growth Pact, and then the reforms of the Stability and Growth Pact, especially in 2011, 2013, and the Fiscal Compact in 2013. So the rhetoric, now we go to Brussels. These new elections are really the watershed. That's what they're saying. It's the watershed. We're going to Brussels. We will change these rules that we don't really like. And then the European Union will be different, will be good again from their point of view. The point is that other populist parties, probably even the same political group in the European Parliament, will have a very different understanding of fiscal rules. So in that sense, the easy prediction would be that they will not really able to do much. Okay, I'll stop here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Nicola. Throwing down the gauntlet there. We'll head over now to Mary.
Well, thank you and so much for the invitation to talk to you. I want to start by following on from some of what the previous speaker said, and I want to start from the whole idea of consensus. And as you said very eloquently, the way that Michel Barnier approached Brexit was to actually talk to everybody, to get people on board, to get if not total agreement, at least an idea of where things were going and what was acceptable, what he could do and what he couldn't do. And that is very much the way that the European institutions work as a whole, as I'm sure you know. When legislation goes through the European Parliament, it's actually much more like the system in America because we are just legislators. There's no executive in the Parliament. And we will seek generally on most things to get agreement of the committee members. Then when it comes to the plenary session where it's passed, to get agreement at least on the substantial things in the legislation at that point. And then if there's any disagreement with the Council of Ministers with whom we are co-legislators, that will be resolved by another lot of negotiations. So it's very much building agreement and getting people on board, and as a result, I think coming up with something which is often very much better than in terms of legislation than it is in the way that we do things in this country, which is very confrontational. As you all know, if you've watched any of the television debates about Brexit in the House of Commons, it's been absolutely appalling. I mean, Europeans cannot believe that we conduct our parliament like that. And I think the contrast between the way that Theresa May has dealt with Brexit and the Europeans, the EU, has dealt with Brexit is a real object lesson in the differences. And it's quite interesting that it looks as if Theresa May's approach is going to fail completely. What that will mean for us in this country, we don't yet know. It could be absolutely catastrophic. And it just shows in the modern day, you have to have agreement or at least a level of getting on with each other and respecting other people's points of view and being able to negotiate so that you end up with something which brings everyone on board. And if there's any lesson for this country that comes out of the whole sad and sorry saga, it's that we really do need to look at the way that we run our government, the way that Parliament functions, the way that the executive functions, and particularly how we deal with the situation which we've got at the moment where there isn't a majority in Parliament. The problem that we have in the system in this country is that it is binary, and it's completely binary. You vote in a first-past-the-post system, and the party that gets the most seats forms the government, which in itself gives governments a level of power which doesn't happen in many other places, and certainly the European institutions, the Council and the Commission, do not have that kind of absolute power. And it is an absolute power. And I think what's happened over Brexit has just been a really good example of it, that Theresa May as Prime Minister has tried to railroad this thing through. And if she'd had a majority of 50, it would have gone through. There would have been no argument about it. It's only got to the position it has got that because she's behaved as if she has a majority of 50 when she actually hasn't got any majority at all. So I think the way that the EU works shows how the importance in modern governance of consensus. And it's also, of course, enabled 27, it was 28, may continue to be 28 member states to work together. And I certainly found this coming from a British political background and having been involved for a very long time before I went to Europe. I just found it actually rather wonderful that people talked to each other and negotiated things and you came to an agreement. I mean, this was such a culture shock. It actually took me quite a long time to get used to it. But it does work, and it works particularly well in the context of the EU, because the EU was originally set up when it was the six to ensure that no one country had more power than anyone else, that there was always a balance. And that's become more important as more countries have joined and countries of very different sizes to allow that equality and equity to work in practice, which has not always been easy, but generally does. Or people will say that Germany's got all the power, followed by France. That may be true sometimes, but it's certainly not true all of the time, and it's not true on most things. I think it's reported in this country because that's the way that the British press likes to see things. They like to see somebody leading, and they can't quite understand that it doesn't really work like that in Europe. So I think that Brexit has really shown this clash of cultures and clashes of methods of government. And I think the country that's got to learn from that is Britain, and rather than the EU. I mean, my view right from the beginning, I'm seriously old, so I actually campaigned. I was a student in 1975, and I campaigned in it was a Remain referendum then. Britain had actually joined the EU in 1973, and Harold Wilson called a referendum in 1975, and which was probably a bit of a mistake, because I think that idea of being able to have a referendum on Europe just carried through, and one of the reasons, maybe not the main one, but one of the reasons why we had it this time. But referendums are a completely other issue, and we perhaps could get into that particular constitutional problem, but it's maybe a bit off the point of what we're talking about here. The relationship, I must come back on this issue of the relationship between the European Parliament and the Member States, because it's actually quite complicated. Ever since the Lisbon Treaty, the European Parliament has felt much more able to sort of do its own thing, if you like, and the Parliament has got stronger and much more confident, and that's been seen this probably won't happen in Brexit. I think when the final vote comes on Brexit, the Labour members might not, but in general, everyone other than the Brits will follow what their member state has done. And that, because it's such an enormous and problematic thing, and it's probably what the MEPs would wish to do anyway, but it doesn't work on less important things. I was an MEP during the Blair Brown years, and Gordon Brown was very opposed to the EU Working Time Directive. I mean, he had a kind of total hatred for it and wanted us to vote against it, which actually, as Labour MEPs, and actually we said, no, we're not going to. We like the Working Time Directive. We think it's a good thing, and we're not actually going to do what you want us to do. And if that happens in the British delegation, that kind of thing will happen in other countries as well. So it's absolutely not a given that MEPs will follow their party at home, or that MEPs will follow their national governments. And I think that is perhaps becoming more obvious now than it was before. And of course, the other thing which it's incredibly important to realise is that the European Union, the EU, does fill in some of the gaps that member state governments don't do. I mean, that's always been the case. I remember in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was trying to do away with a lot of what are known as workers' rights, was actually to just take away chunks of people's rights at work. The EU then at that point introduced a lot of health and safety, that was particularly health and safety and equal opportunities, maternity leave, for instance, and actually provided that framework and that legislation, which certainly wasn't there in Britain and wasn't there in other member states as well. And that trend has become more likely and more apparent as we've gone through this. The EU actually does things which member states don't do. I'm on the Women's Rights and Gender Equality Committee. I'm actually Labour spokesperson on it. And we have done a whole lot of legislation, which certainly isn't happening in this country, and I'm not sure is happening in many other member states, particularly the Eastern European states. We've done legislation on sexual harassment and a whole lot of legislation about the workplace. We have done legislation on gender equality in the provision of goods and services, which again probably wouldn't have happened in the form which it has taken place in. We've done work on violence against women, and we've fought campaigns, non-legislative campaigns, on the gender pay gap, on women on boards, and women on company boards, and many other things as well. And those are things which are not done in all member states, and certainly have not been done under this government in this country. So I think there's an important role across Europe for us, for MEPs, and for the European institutions, for the Commission as well, to take up these big issues, which will work across Europe on a cross-border basis, and run with them and introduce legislation where appropriate. Another legislation in this category is a lot of the environmental legislation is done in Europe, partly because you can't split it up into nation states, and it's an obvious thing to do cross-border. But a lot of what's been done on climate change, on air pollution, air quality, on clean beaches, all of that environmental legislation has come from the EU because it was recognised that it was necessary, and it was either not possible to do it at member state level or member states weren't willing to do it. So I think that the EU is actually carving out a real role for itself in these kinds of legislative areas that member states either find it difficult or don't always want to do. And I think that's a trend which hasn't really been noticed as much as it should have been. But I think, you know, those of us who've been working on this for a while are very aware of that happening. And it's true that the European elections, certainly in this country, have always been regarded as second-order elections. And every single European election I fought, since the first one I did in 1999, was fought on national issues. So it's hardly surprising that people in this country don't know much about the European Union, because it's just not been around. It's not been discussed. It's not taught at school. It's not really debated in the media. So There's a huge and desperate level of ignorance here, which I think is quite unusual in Europe. Most European countries, in fact, I think almost all of them, except for us, are actually proud to be in the EU. They think it's the place they want to be. They see it benefits them. From from France and Germany, who view themselves possibly a bit as the leaders, but they do understand what it means for them, and the kind of cooperation they get in the EU, the economic working together, the euro has actually been good for them, to countries like Ireland and smaller countries who actually owe their prosperity to being in the European Union. And Britain has never felt that, and that's one of the reasons we are in the amazing mess that we are in at the moment. So despite all of this, and maybe to some extent because of it, we are seeing, as has already been said, a rise in populism and the far right. There are already far right parties in the European Parliament, and I class UKIP as a far-right party. I mean, UKIP just bring disgrace on all of us. I mean, it's been positively embarrassing. I don't know how many of you saw that clip on, I think it was Television News, when Nigel Farage made this ghastly speech at the last plenary session, got up and walked out. He does that every single time. And what's worse, in a way, I mean, that's good theatre, but what's worse is that UKIP members just don't turn up. They don't go to committee meetings, and they just don't do any work. And talking about Guy Verhofstadt, which you were earlier, who is a very colourful character, and he is slightly mad, he did once a few years ago now, but it was a wonderful speech about Nigel Farage, because Verhofstadt always speaks in English, so it was actually shown quite a bit in this country, saying that Nigel Farage was at that time a member of the Fisheries Committee, which is one of those boring committees in the European Parliament, which is actually very important. And as we're realising, fishing is actually quite an issue for this country, as we're discovering with Brexit. Anyway, Nigel Farage at the time was meant to be a member of the Fisheries Committee and never turned up. And Guy Verhofstadt had all these statistics about how Farage didn't turn up and how Farage was out there talking about the European Union, didn't have a clue because he was never there. And that's always been the UKIP view of it. But not all the far-right parties are like that. The ENF, the National Front, including Marine Le Pen, they do turn up. And the socialist group, of which I'm a member, a British Labour member, actually has a policy of not voting for anything that the ENF puts forward, which actually gets quite difficult. But they are, on the other hand, they are very active. And I think this is something which we will see further. I mean, I know that there will be more on the rise of populism and the far right, but it is predicted that there will be more far right MEPs. And we do need to watch out for that and be aware of it happening. And actually, I think, deal with it politically. It's no good giving in to these far-right movements. It doesn't work because, like the European Research Group has shown, you give them a bit and they ask for more and they go on asking more. So we have to fight a really hard campaign to minimise as much as we possibly can the rise of the far-right. And my last word, when we're talking about campaigns, one thing Brexit has done in this country, and it's a very important thing, has mobilised people. There were, before Brexit, lots of people who actually were in favour of the EU but didn't really think they needed to do much about it. What's happened with Brexit is they've all been mobilised. The march that's taking place on Saturday, it's predicted there will be over 1 million people turn up. There's now this whole group of people who want to remain in the European Union. And whatever happens with Theresa May's deal, they will not go away. We've now got them. We've got a new movement, a pro-EU movement. And I think that's going to make a big difference to politics in this country.
Nice to end on a happy note. Thank you very much, Mary. Okay, Georgina.
Happy not for everyone, though, in this country. Thank you so much for the invitation, and thank you to you all for being here. As was mentioned, I'm a senior researcher at the Institute for Government, where now for most of my time, look at Brexit. So it's quite nice to sort of dip back into what I used to look at, which was the future of the EU. I've sort of asked to kind of give a brief insight and sort of assessment of the election ahead. It's always great to come third because a lot of points have been picked up, so you can just, you know, speed it along and then have your views come in as well. Look, I think this election is going to matter hugely, and you can already sense it in different member states. EU press is already covering it much earlier than they traditionally do. You see the parties mobilising, and you see actually some EU leaders take an active interest, because I think it is right. There's been this kind of differentiation between, you know, second order elections, and actually since Lisbon, the European Parliament being able to kind of not tie itself as closely to what if you're a Labour MEP and you've got a Labour government in power, can you move away from that or not? What you're seeing now is like Macron basically saying, and when he was campaigning to become president, European Parliament elections are going to be huge, and I'm going to make sure that they are important in France. And now that he's become president, he's going to push that even more. And I think he's not going to be the only one. I think we can watch out for Orban, who might have a different take than Macron, but who's also going to invest quite heavily in these elections. So it's interesting to see, I think, the link and the dynamic between some EU leaders and the EU elections. So why is it important? Well, you'll all know this. Obviously, European Parliament scrutinises EU legislation and has an important power when its co-decision applies. But also there's the Spitzenkandidat process, which is huge as well. Now, what's interesting is the process doesn't say that the Commission President needs to be the Spitzenkandidat from the largest party, so the party with the largest number of seats. It's just that the Commission President has to be a Spitzenkandidat. So I think that is interesting, because it's often lost. So even if EPP, who are predicted at the moment to win most seats, it could be the Spitzenkandidat from another party who becomes Commission President. So Politico have put together this fascinating tracker, which I highly encourage you to look at. And also they send, I think it's every 2 weeks, kind of a take on the European Parliament elections from either groups of countries or specific country. And they say that, and was mentioned by, I think, by Mary, that they expect 1/3 of the seats to be won by anti-EU candidates. But as was said before, those anti-EU candidates are split. They don't align on all the issues. And actually how that plays out in terms of scrutiny, in terms of plenary, in terms of where you kind of navigate that debate will be really interesting. But currently they still expect the EPP, so that's the centre-right party, to win, but to lose overall 42 seats, which is quite substantial, actually. Next, we expect the centre-left to win, but to lose 56 seats. Again, quite substantial. ALDE, so kind of centrist, to go to kind of have 72 seats, so up by four. I do think whether Macron's En Marche align themselves with ALDE or not will make a difference to that, and we know that discussions are ongoing. I think they're having a summit today, and two of the representatives of En Marche were attending that, so we shall see where that goes. And then you'll have obviously the sort of anti-EU candidates occupying a very significant chunk in the European Parliament. Two things to watch out for. I've mentioned En Marche. Do they align themselves with ALDE or do they not? And also what happens with Brexit? And will we have UK MEPs in the next European Parliament? Mary, will you be running? I guess that's a question you might get asked. So briefly, what are the issues that EU citizens care about? Politico have identified some, and I've looked at other studies as well, and it does seem to be always the same ones. One, immigration. Two, terrorism. Three, economic situation. Not just unemployment, but how your wages are doing, are they going to grow, etc. How much are you in control? Can you afford to live the life that you'd like to lead? That kind of stuff. Public finances, that's debt. And finally, unemployment, which is slightly different, but obviously in some countries is a huge concern. I agree with Mary that overall a lot of studies show that people are proud to be European. However, not all feel they have benefited from the EU. And I think that is where the tension lies, because you can be proud of something, but if you think that the system's not working for you, you might end up voting for parties that kind of call into question this identity, this European identity. I think another issue to think about when we think about the European Parliament elections is all around campaigning. It was mentioned before, but it's how do you get people out to vote, essentially? And how do you put together a debate that is not only reflective of their views, but also is inclusive of their views? So too much when we're talking about the EU, too many of the debates are about you're either anti-European or you're pro-European. But actually, it's much more nuanced than that. You've got people who are quite hesitant, who think, well, you know, I'm agnostic, really. Yeah, it seems to be benefiting me, but actually, I don't know how I feel about the EU stance on immigration or on freedom of movement or whatever it might be. So how do you foster a debate that is more inclusive? And I think that will matter hugely, particularly for those parties that are likely to lose seats but still want to be quite influential in the next European Parliament. And then aside from the debate, you have the question of fake news, which you know that President Macron is taking very seriously. But the EU Council right now are talking about it as well, talking about what do you do with interference, how do you respond to fake news, and how do you make sure that there is a balanced debate. I mean, the last European Parliament election, we had debates between the Spitzenkandidaten. I mean, I don't know how many people watched those debates, but it seems to suggest that it's not really the way forward. That's not what people are looking for. They're not looking for debates among these five political figures that they've kind of heard of. They want to make sure that the debate is actually representative of them. And I think that is a key question that MEPs should be thinking about, or at least those who are thinking about running or running again. I want to briefly touch on, I used to work at Chatham House, which is a foreign policy think tank, and some of my colleagues ran a survey 2 years ago in 10 EU countries, polling the public and, for lack of a better word, elite. So all those who kind of inform or directly are involved in policy making. And what they found is, unsurprisingly, there is a gap between the public and the elite on how they see the future of the EU. But there's also an important public divide within the public. So there are some members of the public who are much closer to their elites than they are their fellow citizens. And how does that play out in policy? But also there's a massive split in elites. So actually, even those who are elected, we know that those who are elected to European Parliament have very different views on how they see the EU evolving. But it's more acute than that. It's almost like some people don't really know what they want out of the future of the EU. Some are elected just to kind of break the system and not put forward any solutions. And I think if a third of seats are won by anti-EU MEPs, there is a point where they will have to come up with solutions, because people will be saying, okay, you don't like it, but what is your alternative? And I think there will be more pressure on them to do that if they grow in number. So finally, Brexit. Lots of people are suffering from Brexit fatigue. But I actually think it's a hugely important question. We know that the government has asked for an extension now until the 30th of June. The president of the European Council yesterday said that it had merit, but there might be legal and political problems with it. I think he was probably alluding to the 23rd of May, which is when the European Parliament elections take place. Because can the UK, even if it's set to leave on the 30th of June, can the UK remain a member state but not organise elections? Because you would be denying UK and EU citizens residing in the UK, living in the UK, the right to either vote or stand in European elections. The Commission could bring forward an infringement procedure. The UK could be challenged in courts. I mean, there's a lot of questions going on like that. And I also think there is an element of scepticism amongst member states where they're thinking, oh, yeah, we know what you're like. You're going to ask for an extension, and then come the 30th of June, you'll ask for another extension. And then all of a sudden, the European Parliament won't be able to carry out its functions because we won't have any British representatives. And as you know, or you may not know, at the moment, party lists are being drawn up on the basis of a new configuration, which will have fewer seats, and some of the British seats are being reallocated to member states. So some member states are saying, well, if you're going to take part, then we need to know now, because we're organising our lists and our campaigning, etc. So I think that is important, and I think it's playing on at least a lot of the European Parliament, but also member states, will know more the next week. We'll have no choice but to know more next week. But I think it's so important to sometimes take a step back and realise that actually Brexit isn't happening in a vacuum. There are a lot of other things going on in the EU, a lot of great things, a lot of things that member states aren't looking at or aren't looking at closely. But actually how Brexit unfolds will also, I think, play into some of the debates. Because if anything, it has sparked a debate inside the EU of where do we go and what is our future and where the European Parliament ends up and what election, what European Commission is elected or appointed as a consequence, not elected, sorry, appointed as a consequence of those elections will be hugely informative as to what the EU plans to do next.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. Lots of excellent insights there from our speakers. Lots to discuss. What I'm going to do now is we've got about half an hour remaining for Q&A session. I'll kick us off with the first question to all the panellists, and then I'm going to take questions from the audience. I will take them in rounds of two or three, and then we'll go back to our speakers. My brief question, if I may, that I think is something you could probably all speak to is, we seem to get this, I get the perspective from your talks that there's this assumption that the European Parliament is a little more of a kind of responsible actor than other legislatures. It certainly came across in some of your insights, and I would agree. But I suppose a history of kind of legislative studies tells us that the most responsible chamber always tends to be the one slightly insulated from democratic pressures. And so I wonder if some of the reasons that we see the EP behaving responsibly in terms of interinstitutional relations and in terms of just the legislative process isn't because, although, of course, we have periodic elections, there is still this assumption that there's something in terms of the democratic salient process missing there. And so my question for the panel is, now that we seem to be getting perhaps more politicisation and more salience, is that potentially going to lead to a less responsible EP? And is it a case of, after having spoken for decades about the problem of second-order national contests, that we might be a little careful what we wish for now we have a greater sort of diversity of preferences in the EP? So before you respond, can we just take a few more questions from the audience and then we'll come back to the speakers? So raise your hand, please, if you have a question. There we go. Sorry, we'll take gentleman here first, Sandora.
Thanks. First, thanks for this. Super interesting. My name is Dan from the US. I was just wondering if theoretically you would all support another vote in the UK on the referendum of whether or not to stay in the EU.
Hello, my name is Dora from LSE Ideas. Thank you very much for all of you for your contributions. I have two questions. The first one is for Mary. I would be wondering if the EU has been such a divisive issue back then in 1975, like today. I know the referendum was very different from the one that we had recently, but I would be just wondering whether the debates were equally fierce or the issue was equally so divisive like now. And question two, since I'm from Hungary, I feel compelled to ask what you think about the EPP's decision to suspend Orbán's party. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. So we'll go back to the panelists in the order in which they spoke. So three questions. Would you support another vote in the UK? Was the 1975 campaign equally fierce? And what do you think about Orbán?
You sure? Okay. Yep. So I support a new vote on referendum? I mean, I'm not a British citizen, but I would say that I do, in a sense that I think there's nothing wrong to ask again the people. Yeah, I don't see any politically, let's say, from a political theory point of view, I don't see why you cannot ask a similar question again 3 years or 2 years or 3 years after you asked the people for the first time. So I don't see a logical reason why, you know, if there's maybe a referendum to break the impasse, asking, do you want a no deal? Do you want a Norway plus model? I don't see any reason why you cannot also have another option. So yes, definitely. But one thing about a new referendum, it's like we know that it will be divisive again. It will not. It will be another 51-49, another 52-48, and it's like probably there might be another solution to, you know, like a more constitutional solution. I don't know, but I think whether, you know, even after that referendum, if the UK stays in the EU, it would be like a very divisive UK, like when the issue will not definitely be over. So it will be a lot of problematic anyway. So it's not like another perfect solution either. Then. Shall I continue responding, or
please?
You had the chair, you said, yeah. The responsible actor. So I'll ask you to your question because it's a point that I raised. So I don't want to hear to sound a bit, but it's not that the European Parliament is always very responsible in a sense. It always says yes to the member states. Not at all. That's not what I wanted to say. We can make like a distinction then. You know, again, it's very brash. So it's like I'm adding a lot of nuances in this distinction, but we can divide European issues into sectors. One is single market, and when it comes to single market, you know, all the issues, environment as well, the European Parliament is like a normal actor. So it puts up its fights, you know, it tries to. My point is that when it comes to other issues, what I call core state powers, issues that are very close to the sovereignty of the states, immigration, asylum policy, fiscal rules, then these issues are very direct and important consequences at the national level. So in these issues, the European Parliament sort of knows that the most important actor is the member states, either in the Council or in the European Council, and then they behave responsibly. Will this continue with a more politicized European Parliament? That's a very good question. If maybe a more nationalistic European Parliament, maybe we'll pick up a fight even in these policy areas closer. But as the other two speakers were saying, it's not an issue for the 2019. Now with, you know, one third of the MEPs belonging to like the far right or Eurosceptic, this will not make a big difference here, I would say.
Okay, great, thanks, Mary.
Well, yeah, start with the people's vote. Yes, I do support another referendum. I think what has become very clear during this whole Brexit process is that people. Because of the way the campaign was fought, people were really not clear about what they were voting for. And there was a whole lot of stuff that just wasn't said. And it was all conducted on slogans. I mean, take back control sounds like a great idea, but it doesn't actually get you very further forward. So, and the other thing, of course, is that there was actually illegal activity with data during the campaign, which seems to be kind of being buried, but it's actually very, very important. I mean, if you can actually affect the result of a vote by manipulating data in the way that was done, and that has been proved to have been done, you have to question the result. So I think that's part of it. Part of it is, of course, that people at the time hadn't really much idea of what leaving the European Union would be, because no one's ever done it before. I don't actually blame people for that. It's just the nature of the way it was. And we now we do know, we actually know what the current withdrawal agreement is. So I think it would be quite legitimate to ask the people whether they agree with that or not, which is quite normal practice. When trade unions go away and negotiate a deal for their members, they then bring it back to the members generally to approve it or otherwise. So I don't think there is anything unusual or different or not constitutional in having another referendum. This process was started by a referendum, so there is a logic in having a referendum at the end of it to agree it or not agree it. So I certainly think that people should be given another vote, and I think it's very unfortunate that the current government is so opposed to doing that, because I think that's actually democratic. I mean, I think that would be the democratic way to approach it. There has been a soundbite going around, which I think is not much more than that, though it has a ring of truth to it, that Theresa May feels she can keep bringing her deal back to the House of Commons, so therefore, why can't she bring the deal back to the people, which has a sort of, you know, air of truth about it. So I hope we do end up with another referendum and the people's vote, so that now that it's much clearer what leaving the EU actually means, the people can have a vote on it. And I would actually also say that the original result was very close. David Cameron, for reasons best known to himself, didn't put a threshold on it. And normally with constitutional referendums, there would be a threshold. You would have to get, usually it's about 60% of the vote, 60%, two-thirds. So this referendum, the 2016 referendum, was very close indeed. It was about 1.2 million difference, which actually translates to 600,000 people, 600,000 votes. The electorate was about 41 million. I mean, this is not enough of a difference to base what Theresa May is doing on. I mean, that was not the will of the people. And I do think that we need to bear that in mind. And that in itself, I think, is enough reason to consult the people again, now that they know what's going on. And it's also become clear that there was a lot of fake news and a lot of illegal use of data. So I think there are very, very good reasons for having another referendum. Yeah, I will answer the question about 1975. It was very different. It was very different. And the affirmative referendum was actually passed by two-thirds. It was absolutely overwhelming. And it was quite interesting, and I think in there's many ways it shows how times have changed. It was a referendum called by the government, though actually Harold Wilson didn't lead it in the way that David Cameron led the last one, so that there was a sort of distance there. And it was done very cross-party as well. I mean, there were local cross-party committees. So it was quite a different thing, and times were very different then. But there certainly wasn't the sort of nastiness and the divisiveness that we've seen now about the EU. It was quite a different attitude. It was much calmer. I mean, there were strong views, and there was a strong, particularly in the Labour Party, a strong anti, what was the common market then, feeling. But it didn't spill over to the kind of atmosphere that we have about it now. And I think will the European Parliament behave less responsibly if it were more democratic? I mean, I've had so many arguments about the democratic legitimacy of the European Parliament. And my own view on this is that we should stop viewing it like we view national parliaments. I mean, we're talking here about a supranational international institution made up of 28 still member states. It's going to function differently from a directly elected government in any member state. And in that sense, I guess maybe it means it won't have quite the democratic structures that a member state parliament would have. And the parliament, of course, doesn't generally work on its own anyway. It works with the Council of Ministers, which are ministers of the elected government, to do the legislation, and the commission, the civil service, will draft the legislation. So it does function differently. And I agree that there are issues which are much closer to the people in member states than others. And that I think will always be a division. But in terms of some of them, it will have to be done on a European level. Immigration and asylum, as we've seen with the refugee crisis, just affects the whole of Europe, as does much of the fiscal issues, because there is actually a single currency. There are raging arguments, of course, about how far integration would go and how far, which will affect the democratic structures. And Macron, part of his whole desire to have reform is to increase integration. And that's really, I think, what a lot of this is about. Britain clearly has never wanted integration and decided that it's a very bad idea. So I don't know. I don't feel, from where I sit, that the EU is less democratic than member state governments, but it is a different level and a different form of democracy. I mean, we can argue about democracy as forever. I mean, you know, I'm elected, the Council of Ministers, because they're member state governments, are elected, and they come together to work on behalf of this supranational organisation. And I think we should just start thinking about democratic legitimacy in those circumstances and in a rather different way. Orban, yes, I think the EU has taken the right decision. There are actually agreed rules about how the EU should behave in certain circumstances, and certainly with actually politicising the judiciary, Orban badly overstepped the mark. And there's also been the whole question of the border to keep refugees out, amongst other things. And also there's been a whole attack on press freedom in Hungary. And if you're going to have an institution like the EU, you have to have basic values and rules and regulations to keep the thing functioning. I mean, the EU is member states voluntarily coming together to be part of it. And therefore, you have to make sure that everybody behaves in a reasonable fashion, an unacceptable fashion which is acceptable to the other member states. And I think Orban's just gone past that. So it was a sad, but I think in the circumstances, a correct decision.
Thanks, Georgina.
Thank you for excellent questions. Perhaps very, very briefly on politicisation of the European Parliament. Does it, you know, make it less responsible? I think there is a real question for the EU right now is what do we become and where do we go from here? Because there's the Macron vision of integration. He's trying to get Merkel on his side. For bits, I think Germany will support him, but there are other areas where they're a little bit sceptical of following Macron down the road. And then we've got lots of other member states. I think the Netherlands are thinking, okay, if the UK leaves, then we're going to have to play a more important role, for example, or we might have to play a bridge role. And fundamentally, I think member states have a choice. Do they integrate further or do they decide to go through a differentiated integration, which is, you know, those who want to do more, those who want to do less, and then are there opportunities for neighbouring countries to play a role in that? Without going into how it will work and what structures you need and avoiding being told by neighbours who are no longer part of the club what you should do. But there are questions about where the EU goes. So I think that's almost like a more fundamental question before we start talking about politicisation. But there we go. On another vote, I think we need to remember that it's basically just not a yes or no. I think there's the whole question of how you organise a second referendum. What happens if you have a lower turnout but a very close call? Does that make it more democratic? What questions do you put on the ballot paper? Also, and then how long do you need to kind of organise a campaign? I think there are lots of questions of how you do that. I'm not saying they're impossible, but I'm saying they're things that we should be thinking about. And then I think often we haven't really asked the EU how they felt about it. I mean, I think push come to shove, they would probably be okay with the UK remaining. In fact, Mary, I'd be really interested in your view on this. But there is also Brexit fatigue over there. And if the EU's plan is to integrate further, then where does the UK fit? And would the UK feel comfortable in that kind of union? I think those are important questions as well. We forget with Brexit that the UK is changing, but the EU is changing also. And I think you need to be wary of that. And then, of course, how the UK feels. I mean, Robert Peston, who you probably know, ran a poll on Twitter. So like all the data analysts here, don't shun me. But he said, you know, he gave a series of options. How would you feel? And quite a lot of them said, oh, gosh, I just want to stop this process altogether and revoke Article 50. But what I'd be interested to know is, were all of them saying that because they wanted to remain a member of the EU, or was it partly, actually, I just want to stop this process and it's driving me mad and I'm not super enthusiastic, maybe we can trigger the process later. I mean, you know, voter attitudes change, and I think that's important as well. I think that would be, yeah.
That's great, thanks. Okay, another round of questions. So we've got the lady over here.
Yeah, I apologize if this question has been already asked, but I'm interested in the women's representation in the upcoming elections, because we may observe that from the 90s it has gradually rised. So it's, I feel it's about like now about 36%. So do you expect that it even may reach the 40% how it's now in Scandinavian countries? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentleman over here.
Hi, I'm Josh Esteen here. I was wondering, you talked initially about the EU having somewhat of an image problem here in the UK. And, I mean, Mary, you stressed a lot of the educational aspect. People don't really know about that. But also about, especially also by Georgina later, about the how the British citizen hasn't really felt any positive impact contributed by the EU. I suppose part of my question would have been answered just by the education aspect, to have more education. But what, in terms of concrete ideas, how could the EU, I mean, might be a bit late now, but how could the EU have done more or improved its image? What could they have done to make the British citizen feel like the EU was having a positive impact? A second question, because there's this petition going on to revoke Article 50 right now, and it's received unprecedented interest. The website right now is down. It's at 1.3 million almost, I think. There have been a lot of petitions. Do you think this changes anything, or is it just another petition, another debate that doesn't lead to any concrete outcome? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And yes, we've got two questions here. We'll take both of them, then we'll go back to our panel.
Yeah, hi, I'm Tay. I'm a student here. My question is about voter turnout for these elections in general. In some member states, for example, Croatia, where I'm from, only 25% of eligible voters actually come out. And so with the rise of populism and nationalism in many member states, do you think we will see an increased turnout as people go out to polls, whether to sort of show support for these populist parties or just to vote against? Thank you.
Hi there. I'm wondering what your advice might be to this government about how it might influence the European Parliament in the future in light of some of the changes that you've spoken about in its composition and the pressures that it's facing, the things that it's considering, and the fact that we think we'll be a third country.
Okay, wonderful. Excellent questions. Thank you very much. We'll go back to our panellists now. We'll go in reverse order, if that's okay. I'll ask you to speak for no more than 4 minutes, because we've only got 12 minutes left. And so the questions quickly were on women's representation, whether the EU has an image problem in the UK, how to solve it, whether the new petition changes anything, is there a problem with turnout, particularly in some member states, and what advice would you give to the British government to influence the EP?
Feel free to stop me after 4 minutes. So very briefly on women turnout, I think that's a really interesting question, and we'll have to see what pans out. But if you take ALDE, who haven't nominated a Spitzenkandidat, but have a Spitzengroup, a Europe team, I mean, five, I think, out of the seven are women. So that's really interesting. I'd be interested. I think Mary's probably the person on this panel who knows most about this. Positive impact. I mean, do look at the study. It actually was reflective of what we found in 10 EU countries, so not just in the UK, this sense of, yeah, I'm actually proud to be European, but I don't feel I've benefited. Well, how do you show that? It's because I think a lot of people feel that the EU isn't listening to them. So perhaps part of it is what are the concerns of EU citizens, and is the EU responding to that? And I think that applies to national governments as much as it does the European Union. I remember seeing a quote by, it was in an interview actually with Hillary Clinton. She said, I realised after that You know, every time someone told me that they had a problem, like I came up with a legislative solution when all they wanted was kind of to be listened to in the first instance. And then to, and I think that that perhaps is something that you should be thinking about. On voter turnout, I mean, I don't know enough about it. But from what I read is that, yeah, it tends particularly because the European Parliament elections have traditionally been seen as second order and a way to get back to your back at your national government. Then, yeah, if you know, those parties have done really well. But then the Green Party has also done really well, whereas in some states it doesn't do as well. So I don't know enough about it. But I think that is something that's certainly playing on Macron's mind. He talks about it all the time. You know, you need to go out, you need to vote, and, you know, you need to take this seriously. And then on the UK influence, on the European, so actually the Institute of Government, we're publishing a report in 2 weeks' time looking at what the government needs to do to prepare for phase two negotiations. Because even if the UK leaves with no deal, it's going to have to come back at some point in Brussels and negotiate. And then we'll be doing our next phase of research is going to be looking at influence and engagement in Brussels and after Brexit. And we're going to be looking exactly at that issue. And I think what you pick up in conversations, but also what you hear in the House of Commons and in the House of Lords, is that that engagement with the European Parliament is going to become, it's going to be really important, because actually it's not just about mobilising, lobbying the Commission and member states. It's also about engaging European Parliament, because there are elected representatives of, and they sometimes have direct links to national parliaments. And so, you know, there is, I think it will become important, but it depends on how things play out over the next couple of weeks.
Thank you very much. Erin?
Yeah, I'll start with the question about women. Every European election, the Women's Committee actually does try and get more women to stand. We actually have quite strong campaigns to get women to stand. And I mean, 36%, which, as you rightly said, is what it is now, is actually pretty good. I mean, the House of Commons is 22%. So we shouldn't beat ourselves up too much about that, because actually the European Parliament is significantly better. I mean, there are always problems in legislatures about women with children. But I have had colleagues, the European Parliament's much better about this. I mean, I've had several colleagues now who have actually brought youngsters, babies and toddlers into the Parliament, and it's just completely accepted now. The Parliament itself has a crash, which seems to work quite well. There's always the problem of the travel, and you have to get there and you have to be away. That is, I think, quite a big issue, particularly with the European Parliament. But I think there's been much more encouragement of women, and there are, of course, member states who have national quotas. I mean, the Sweden and Denmark actually have government quotas for the number of women who have to be candidates. In other member states, political parties have quotas, which actually the Labour Party does. And I've always been a strong supporter of quotas, because I think, until you get to the point where you get half and half, you need actually to provide a way through, because women don't get into positions because they can't do it or they're worse than men. They don't get into positions because the culture is against them and it's seen that women can't do these jobs. It's not that they can't do them, it's that they're perceived to not be able to do them. So there has to be a way through this, and some sort of quota system, I think, it is the only way to do it. We managed to get to 36% on the basis of each member state having a different system of quotas and some not having any at all. And it would be great if we got to 40%. I have to say, and I will be political at this point, which I've tried not to be throughout, the left parties are far better at female representation than the right-wing parties. I think it's because left-wing parties tend to want more women, they do more to encourage women, but it's actually very noticeable in representative assemblies. It's very noticeable also in the House of Commons. So I think, you know, if anyone wants to do any work on this, it's probably with the right-wing that we need to do it. The image problem, yeah, I know, when we you know, the EU, and it is part of the issue, has had a terrible image, particularly in this country, but it's not only in this country. I think a lot of member states feel that the EU is distant from them. They don't know quite what the EU does. It's one of those sort of circular arguments. The EU is a long way removed from voters, citizens, as they like to call you. I think for a British person to talk about citizens is a bit strange, actually. But the EU terminology is citizens. And of course it's going to be a long way from the citizens because it's a layer above national government. And so when you see, it's been interesting what, during Brexit, that the key figures have actually been on British television all the time. So we've kind of got to know them, but it's taken Brexit for that to happen. And if you don't know who runs institutions, you tend not to like them. If you don't like what you don't know. And I think what's striking, and no one ever talks about this, every single one of those leaders that we see speaks perfect English. You know, Donald Tusk makes a statement on, and it works on British television because he does it in English. Michel Barnier, I saw on the news before I came out, speaking in English. We never talk about this. It's a huge bonus for this country. And, you know, if we started actually analysing and talking about some of these basic things a bit, it might actually help. Will revoking the petition to revoke Article 50 do anything? I mean, I do think public pressure actually is good, and can change things, because politicians have to get themselves elected again. And if by this stage 1.3 million people have signed up to this petition, it's a lot. The march on Saturday will be huge. Theresa May seems to be able to ignore this sort of thing, but most politicians don't and can't, because it's very much a demonstration of how people are feeling. And the threshold for a petition done in this way online to be debated in Parliament is 100,000. This has now got over a million and may well, and is probably still going up. So this is huge in terms of these petitions. This is huge, and the march will be huge. And I just think it's important that we keep up this public pressure, because politicians eventually will have to respond to it, and will need to respond to it, because they've got to get themselves re-elected. Voter turnout, well, it's linked to the question about people don't know much about the EU. In fact, in this country, EU election turnout is about the same as turnout for local government elections. And general elections in this country, turnout actually fluctuates quite a lot between whether people think that the election will bring about a change of government or whether they think it's more of the same. I mean, there's quite a big change in voter turnout, which actually means that people will vote when they think it's worth doing. We should have more campaigns. People should know more about the EU, understand more about it. That might help. In some countries, there is compulsory voting. Belgium has compulsory voting. And I'm never sure that's a solution. But it's an interesting thought. But I think basically we just need to have rather better election campaigns, talk more about the EU and get people to understand the importance of it. I think that's essentially what you have to do, and do a lot of it. Last answer, how can the government influence the European Parliament in the future? Well, they could start by taking an interest in us. That might help. I mean, there are actually all sorts of contacts between MEPs and national parliaments, formal and informal. So a lot of this infrastructure is actually there, and all member states have permanent representatives, civil servants, whose job it is to do some of that linking. Certainly in the European Parliament, for us, when there's when there's any legislation going through, the permanent representation, the civil servants, will come and talk to us about it. And within the party structure, there's also links. So it's not as if we're operating in completely separate universes, though I have to say sometimes it feels a bit like that. And I think that's probably the way it would go, to keep that a fairly informal way of doing it and influence in that way. I'm not sure that there should be more formal structures and whether they would work even if they existed. It's important, I think, to have the European Parliament as an independent institution and not linked too much to member state governments.
Okay, thank you. Nicola, two minutes.
2 minutes, okay. I'll be very quick.
So I'll pick up maybe some of these questions then. So one brief comment on the image of the EU in the UK. I mean, one thing is to maybe, if you have this agenda, to improve the image. Another thing, it's salience. There are two different things. Salience, salience of European issues in the national parliament, in the national context. But we still have to take into account that at the end of the day, the money is still at the national level. So things that citizens care, like welfare, education, all these kind of things, are still decided by national parliaments, national governments. So it's limited the extent to which you can really, politicize these issues. It's a cliche, but it's still true that most of the things decided in Brussels are about regulation of the single market. Second, but one thing is that, probably we don't have time. on UK government influencing the European Parliament, I think Georgina and Mary already mentioned quite a lot. I just want to echo what Mary was saying, is that, in the UK PEMREP, there's a European Parliament team. They just focus on the European Parliament. And already with these negotiations, the size of the ACREP, of the UK permanent representations in Brussels, has increased. And it will probably increase even more after Brexit, because they will have to influence the EU from outside. I'm pretty confident that the UK government will be able to do so. Norway, Switzerland, they're all already trying to do it, and I'm confident that the UK will be better at doing that, because they're better diplomats, everything. Now it seems like a shampoo, ironic these days, but it's actually true. Final point about voter turnout. The problem is, there's a problem, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, as you know, that the voter turnout is especially low there. But I think that, because as you probably know, voter turnout in the European Parliament elections decreased since 1979. So 1979 was the first election, and it always went down. Probably now we'll see, maybe my prediction, maybe it will increase a little bit, not much, because things are a little bit more politicized, but in some countries, not in others. But I'll conclude with this, and agree with Mary, that we should not be too much obsessed about voter turnout in the European Parliament elections, in my view. If you look at the Mayor of London, you know how many people voted for the Mayor of London? So, do you have an idea? So for Sadiq Khan, it was 45%. So pretty much like the European elections. Boris Johnson's in 2012, the voter turnout was 38%. So I think we should also put things into perspective sometimes.
Okay, that's brilliant. Thank you very much. A lot of food for thought there. Obviously, you have to wait and see how everything pans out during and after the elections. Before you join me in thanking the speakers, can I just point out that you have LSE Ideas feedback forms in front of you or somewhere near you? Please do fill these in. Your views are very important to us, and it helps shape the kind of events that we organise. So, without further ado, let me thank you for coming and our three wonderful speakers for sharing their thoughts with us this evening. Thank you very much.